Hi, everybody. It's a great pleasure for me to be here. And we are having very exciting times in the lab right now, and it's great to have a meeting at that time to discuss all these things. I'd like to thank the organizers for putting this meeting together and for inviting me to come here. So this is an impression of Innsbruck. Yeah, okay, we do our research here at that place. And so I start with a photo of the team and the people working in the lab. So the grad students on the experiment are Selim, Markus, and Alexander. Two undergrad students, Stefan and Gerhard. Senior scientist in my group, Johannes. And as a postdoc, Chen Cheng, who is here in the audience. Okay, you see the setup here. It's relatively small and compact. I mean, at least if I compare it with Wolfgang's machine there, it fits on a relatively small table here. And the reason for that is we only need lithium-6. It's a lithium-6 only experiment, no sympathetic cooling. And we work with optical trapping right away without using a magnetic trap before. So this makes the experiment relatively simple and robust and small. Okay, so just a short introduction. You have seen these things already. We work with a spin mixture of lithium-6 atoms in the lower states. So we have the atoms in these two, in the lowest two states, labeled here as 1 and 2. And there's these, we work with these very broad Fechner resonance, which is centered at 800 something Gauss, and it's very, very broad. Okay, so this is the outline of my talk. I first going to talk on the molecular BEC, and want to convince you that the molecular BEC is an excellent starting point for doing these kind of experiments. Then several topics related to the crossover. I want to show that the crossover takes place reversible in this lithium-6 Fermi gas. Our contribution to the question, where exactly is the Fechner resonance? And then on the collective excitations. And then a little bit about new experiment that we've been doing in the last few weeks. Okay, so first about the molecular BEC. So this is a sketch of our trap. So it's an optical trap, tightly focused near-infrared laser beam at a wavelength of 1030 nanometer. And its initial power is 10 watt. And we can hear one special feature of the trap is a precise control of the laser power, starting with 10 watt, and we go down to a few hundred microwatt, and we can very well control the power of that beam, for example, for doing evaporative cooling or for recompression of the sample, and so on. So this is one of the special features. The other special feature is that actually it's not completely an optical trap that we are using. It's in two dimensions an optical trap. In the radial direction, it's an optical trap, but in the axial direction, we have a magnetic trap because the field has a certain curvature. It has a kind of, when you go along the laser beam, it has a maximum insight. And because we work with high field seeking atoms, this gives a 1D magnetic trap. And this has the nice feature that the trap is, say, perfectly harmonic. And we know the trapping frequency, the axial frequency, very, very well, with a per mil precision, something like this. Okay, so this is a trap, and this is how we make the BEC. So Wolfgang has explained the procedure already very nicely, and he pointed out, I mean, how amazingly simple that is. So we work at a fixed magnetic field, 764 Gauss, and we just perform the whole evaporation at that fixed field, starting with 10 watts in the trap and going down to typically 2 or 3 milliwatts. And so during the evaporation, which is here over 2 seconds, now we work with 4 seconds full evaporation time, makes it a little bit more robust. We see the formation in these images here. So these images are in situ images. So we look at the cloud in situ and get our information from the axial distribution. We see here the formation of the BEC, a BEC in a little thermal cloud, and we end up with an essentially pure molecular BEC. So these are two axial profiles. This is a partially condensed sample here, and this one is a almost pure BEC. So fitting these images, we get a minimum condensate fraction of 90%. So we know we start with a system which is in the BEC limit. It is at least 90% condensed.
How low are you from the resonance?
So this is at 764. So these measurements are made, we evaporated 764, but then we decreased the magnetic field, we ramped it down, and we measure at 690, something like this, where the system is no longer strongly interacting. It's almost the BEC limit here. So at this field, at our evaporation field, 764 Gauss, we measure a lifetime, it's hard to measure it, but I mean a lifetime of 40 seconds for the system. So it's almost infinite on the time scale. And under all conditions we explore, I mean close to the resonance, I mean we get this incredibly long lifetime, no loss. This molecular BEC is our starting point for all further experiments. We always prepare the molecular BEC first, and then ramp to different situations, different coupling strength in an adiabatic way. So I now come to the crossover, to a degenerate Fermi gas. Okay, this is the illustration. I just copy and pasted from this last August science paper. I think I don't have to explain this illustration here. The two limits and the crossover in between, and we are so much excited about the crossover because we don't really know what is going on there, and it's related to so many different fields in physics. So this is our first experiment to explore the crossover. So we produce the BEC somewhere here, 764 Gauss, where the system is weakly interacting or almost weakly interacting. The gas parameter is something like 4% here. And then we just ramp up the magnetic field closer to resonance. What we see is that the cloud size increases on resonance, beyond the resonance in the Fermi gas regime. And so we see a smoothly increasing cloud size. So one important question was, is this kind of ramping and conversion process, is that adiabatic? I mean, does it conserve entropy? And so one thing we did to test that is to start with a molecular BEC, ramp up to a Fermi gas close to 1.2 kilogauss within a second. And then we ramp back another second, and then we compare that situation with a situation that we just wait on the same field for 2 seconds. And then we compare the two different profiles, and we try very hard to see a difference in these profiles, but I mean, all what we see is just noise. So there's very good news, I mean, for these experiments for lithium-6, due to the very, very long lifetimes, we can perform the crossover in a reversible and lossless way. And when we start with our 90% condensed sample in the BEC limit, then we can use the arguments of these recent Carr et al. Paper on the temperature that we would get in the Fermi gas limit, and this temperature would be 0.03 in the Fermi gas limit. So, and this is an upper limit for the temperature. So that means we have temperatures on somewhere in the region of a few hundredths of T Fermi. Okay, so these are the data on these experiments on the cloud size. So we see here the raw data, the cloud size that we measure from the in situ absorption images. And we see that the cloud size goes up and then down again. But this effect that the cloud size goes down again is due to the trap, our magnetic trap. When we increase the Feshbach field, then we also increase the curvature. And so this makes the sample a little bit smaller. And so what we do is we normalize the data to the size of a non-interacting Fermi gas, and we get this curve here out. So the increase in the BEC case, here the crossover region on resonance, and then a little further increase, and then it gets flat and levels off. So what we can get out of this plot is, I mean, this line here, this is the calculation for the BEC limit using these 0.6 times A scatterlings for the molecule-molecule interaction. So it fits quite well.
Is that no adjustable parameter fit?
This is, there's no adjustable parameter. So I would say within a factor, a little bit better than a factor of 2, we can determine the scattering length from that. And what else can we get out of this plot? We can get out these psis at the resonance position, and this universal case on resonance. And the size is here, according to this measurement, 75% of the size of a non-interacting Fermi gas. So the error comes from our limited knowledge of the number of atoms. So we cannot determine the size of the non-interacting Fermi gas so accurately. And this is an interesting universal parameter on the resonance. People usually express it in terms of the beta parameter, which is related to the size, the relative size, here in that way. And I mean, in this measurement, so within the error bar, we get agreement with the most recent theoretical calculation on this beta parameter. However, there's one important point. Here we assume the resonance at 850 Gauss. At that time we did the experiment, there was limited knowledge of the exact resonance position, and we knew it was the data, older data and the NIST calculations. We know it within a few 10 Gauss. And so you see, when you look at the slope here, it really makes a difference. I mean, when you are 10 or 20 Gauss off here, then it makes a difference in measuring this parameter. And so this is another uncertainty which is not included really in this error bar. So question, where exactly is the resonance? One motivation for addressing this question. So these are three profiles we got on resonance. On resonance or very close to resonance, and a little bit below the resonance, above the resonance. You see that the actual profiles are smooth. There's no particular feature there. It's for the coldest samples we have. And so a Thomas Fermi profile fits quite well. So we were not expecting anything really exciting from these measurements, and we didn't observe any surprises here. So, but now coming back to the question, where exactly is the Feshbach resonance, our contribution to that? So, the method we use is radio frequency spectroscopy. And so the basic idea is that now have, these are the three high field seeking states of the lithium-6 atom. And we have one atom here and one atom in state number two. And the difference is essentially the nuclear spin, which is still a little bit coupled to the electron spin. So the idea is to apply a radio frequency here. And when there's no interaction here, then we simply see the atomic transition line. And so this is an example. This is a lost signal. We always look at the number of atoms remaining in this state two. And so the width of this lost signal is typically 200 hertz. We got signals, down to a width of 100 hertz here. So this allows us to measure the magnetic field precisely it gets very narrow, a pretty good resolution here. And but what happens now when we assume that there is that these particles are bound together, there's a molecular bond or something like this, then you would expect that you need some extra energy to break the pairs. And you would expect that the molecular signal is upshifted with respect to the atom signal. Okay, and what do we see? This is what we see in the case of an atom-molecule mixture at 720 Gauss is that. And we see a clear atom peak, which is well separated from the molecular peak. And one can extract the binding energy by looking at the threshold here. And this allows us to determine the binding energy, which is here in this example, 120 megahertz at 720 Gauss. Okay, so we did this. Okay, but first, this is the calculation that we got almost 2 years ago from Vanessa Venturi. And so this is a calculation of the binding energy. What I plot is the square root of the binding energy in microkelvin. And so this calculation, as a resonance position, the exact resonance position where A diverges at 856 Gauss. And they state an uncertainty of this calculation of a few 10 Gauss. Actually, this calculation was done after ours and John Thomas' measurement of the zero crossing. We found the zero crossing of the scattering length at 530 Gauss. But there's an uncertainty in the potentials, and this translates into this uncertainty of the resonance position. So when we now plot the data of our binding energy measurements, we find this. Okay, you see that the data are systematically below by typically 15 gauss or a little bit more. And so our preliminary way to analyze these data is just to shift the magnetic field scale a little bit of this binding energy calculation. And we get nice agreement in this way. And when we look now on the resonance position here, we find it at 837 gauss. And we estimate an uncertainty, which doesn't come from the fit, but only from this very crude procedure of just, shifting the magnetic field scale around, of 55 gauss in this procedure. So if you compare it to other values, so Wolfgang has reported on the 822 at MIT, and so Randy communicated 838 gauss position with a 1 gauss error. So it seems that we agree with Randy's measurement, not with the MIT data. But it's a question, of course we believe that our data is right, but perhaps there's some physics behind it. We really have to analyze both ways to determine the resonance position, and perhaps there's some interesting physics hidden in that kind of discrepancy. Okay, so let me now come to the collective excitation measurements.
So how much errors in beta if they introduce?
Yeah, the beta, yeah. Oh yeah, it's getting. If you use the 822 resonance position, our beta is way off, so I don't like it very much. Yeah, the 837, it's still quite okay. Yeah. Okay. So about the collective excitation. So Sandro Stringari pointed out that there should be an interesting behavior of the collective excitation modes in the crossover regime. Interesting non-trivial behavior. So we study the lowest two oscillation modes, the axial one, which is low frequency. So this is made in a cigar-shaped trap, I have to say, with a radial frequency of 750 hertz and an axial frequency a little bit more than 20 hertz. And so we study the axial oscillation and the radial compression mode here. Let's first look into the data of the axial mode. So these are some oscillation data, so we get for the radial mode, just to show you the quality of these pictures. And now let us look at the axial oscillation frequency as a function of the magnetic field. So we plot the frequency of the mode normalized to the sloshing mode. So this takes out some anharmonicity effect, so we had to take care that we are not affected by anharmonicity. So what we see is that we start with this square root of 5/2 oscillation frequency in the BEC limit. Then it goes a little bit down when we approach the resonant, goes a little bit further down, and then it goes up and approaches the collisionless value of 2 omega. You see that the error bars here are quite large. The reason is that we get relatively large damping here. But let us first look into the resonance region. And in a close-up here, so this is the 2 in the collision limit, and here we get the data in the very close to resonance. And here we see that from the BEC limit to the resonance position, we have a 2% shift. Yeah? And this 2% shift is expected from the equation of states there. And so the frequency should be a square root of 12 over 5. If you compare it with the square root of 5 over 2, then it's just a 2% shift. And this red star here shows, that our experimental data agree very nicely with that 2% shift. Actually, I have to point out that the trap is very harmonic. This is due to the axial magnetic confinement. So we can measure the axial frequencies with a per mil precision here. Okay. So,
Can I just check? Yeah. So the cone mode is you measure that and that exists, the sloshing mode.
Yeah, so we also measure the sloshing mode, dipole oscillation.
It should exist, but you're saying it does exist? And it's
yeah, the sloshing, sure. So it just gives us our omega, our trap frequency. We just use it to check the trap frequency.
Later. It's not obvious, but it's nice that you did get it.
And And so this point here, the unitarity point, we get very nice agreement, confirms the equation of state, but look at the fashion of resonance position. We assume our 837 here. If we assume 822, then we get a little discrepancy. So it's one way, I mean, you can interpret the data. If you believe in universality on resonance, then this is a way to determine, another way to determine the fashion of resonance position. And this is more in favor of the 837 position here. Okay, but now let's look at the damping. So we see that we have little damping here in the BEC situation, very, very small damping close to the resonance. Actually, the system oscillates for many seconds, 5 seconds or so, and then damping goes up as the system approaches the Fermi gas region. And so actually this increase in damping is consistent just with a kind of crossover from the from a hydrodynamic situation to a collisionless situation. So we never reach the collisionless situation here in the axial mode. This is because the axial oscillation is so slow that it's hard to reach the 2 omega regime here. So let us look into the resonance region again. I mean, this is a close-up of these data. Actually, we found the lowest damping rates at the field of 815 Gauss. For a 5 seconds oscillation time, very, very low damping. And it's quite interesting to note the coincidence that this field of 815 Gauss coincides with the field where Wolfgang has seen the MIT experiments, the highest condensate fraction. I don't know whether this is a coincidence or whether it has to tell us something, but it's a very interesting coincidence. Okay, but now let's turn to the radial collective excitation mode. So for the frequency, we observe this. So already in the what we believe to be the BEC limit, we see a significant deviation from the 2 omega mode. So it's about 1.9 here where we start. And then when we increase the coupling strength closer to resonance, the frequency goes down. Here, the threshold resonance, the unitarity point is reached. And then it goes further down to about 1.5 is the frequency ratio. And then something very remarkably happens. So the frequency goes rapidly up to the 2 omega situation here, the collisionless situation. So actually, when we got this data, so we found it surprising in three different respects, three surprises. One is that in the BEC limit, the expected beyond mean field correction for a strongly interacting BEC should increase the frequency. Actually, we see already a decrease here at that point. And so it has roughly the same magnitude, but the opposite sign as compared to expected beyond mean field corrections. So at the universality point, we get a frequency ratio of, 1.65. And expected this universality point would be 1.83, square root of 10 over 3. So this is way off. And so the axial measurement tells us everything is okay with the equation of states. And so something else is happening here. So the frequency is way off the expected hydrodynamic frequency at the unitarity point. And then third, I mean, these sharp transition to a collisionless situation. What's that? Okay, let's look into the damping rates. We see that we have pretty low damping rates in the BEC regime. Actually, quite the same values John Thomas is going to report about. And then we see, at this sharp transition, we see a very, very large damping. And beyond this kind of transition, there is some damping, which is significantly higher as compared to the BEC limit. So what does this tell us? I mean, this rapid change in the frequency, in the oscillation frequency, in the large damping, obviously, some kind of a transition is going on, so the system is collisionless here. It's certainly hydrodynamic here, and we believe in the BEC limit. It is, as a BEC, it is superfluid. So the interesting question is, I mean, is this, the system superfluid up to that point, and does this transition mark a transition from a superfluid to a collisionless situation? But we have to understand the nature of that transition. Okay, I come to the last point.
You still have the minimum of damping at resonance as in the NDS.
Yeah, it seems like this. Yeah, it's in the same region here. Okay, come to the last part of my talk. New experiments we have been doing in the last few weeks, and this is about the pairing gap. Actually, and I have to say that we're very happy that we got Cheng Xin in our group about a year ago. He has contributed a lot, has been a driving force in many of these experiments, in particular in these things. So let me come back to the radio frequency spectroscopy situation. I've explained this already. So we break the molecules, and this needs some extra energy. Okay, and the molecular signal is then upshifted. But I mean, this is of course a more general thing. If we have pairs, then there should be a pair signal in the radio frequency spectroscopy signals and some upshift there. So you have seen this picture already. Well, this is in the molecular, in the BEC limit. So for a hot sample here, we only see the atom peak. For a sample where the which is close to the temperature is close to TC for the molecules, we see this structure of the atom peak and also the molecular signal. And when we continue and evaporate down, then we see that the molecule signal is completely disappearing here. And we see the molecule signal again. And I want to point out that the molecule signal here, so this is made in a much more shallow trap, but the molecule signal has the same shape. There's no change. I mean, this is only two-body physics here. So the molecular signal is two-body physics. But now, let's look at the same thing, but let's look close to resonance or on resonance. So what we do is we interrupt the evaporation process somewhere, and then we look again into the radio frequency signals. And so what we do is the interrupted evaporation, we adiabatically change the field and then take the radio frequency spectra. What you see here is at 822 Gauss, we see a kind of a double peak structure. There's this narrow peak, which is located exactly there where the atom peak is located, and this broad signal here, which is shifted to higher frequencies. Note that the scale here is different, so this is about 10 times expanded scale as compared to that one. And when we cool further down, when we have this in the BEC limit, then we get this signal here close to resonance, which is clearly shifted. Here the zero is the atom signal. It's shifted by a little bit more than 10 kilohertz here. And it depends on the trap. I mean, this is a much deeper trap, and this is a much more shallow trap. And the width of the signal also changes with the trap. So this is clearly not two-body physics. So we estimate the temperature here to be something like 0.2 T Fermi with a large error bar. And we interpret this signal as the atomic peak and here this other signal as the paired fraction. And when we go down to the low temperatures, the atom peak disappears and we see pairs only at temperatures which are a few hundredths of T Fermi. So actually, this is certainly many-body physics. And let me now look on our resonance position, the 837, on resonance. And we still see that double peak structure. It is a little bit less pronounced as compared to that situation, but very clearly visible. So this is the paired signal at very low temperatures. When we continue these kind of measurements to higher fields where the coupling gets weaker and weaker, this we interpret as the pairing gap here, showing up here. And so when we continue these measurements to up to 875 Gauss, we can still see, it's a little bit noisy, but we can still see this double peak structure, and the atomic peak disappears here when we go further down. So we interpret this as a pairing gap in a strongly interacting Fermi gas. So
can we go back to the slide? Is the atomic peak moving over to where it looks like the pair peak is moving over to where the atomic peak was?
Yeah, so this is because the trap is much more shallow here. I mean, this is still, the evaporation situation. And so the Fermi energy goes down by a factor of 3 or so. This is not made at constant Fermi energy, but this is made at just during the evaporation. Let me show this to you. So this is the This is the molecular binding energy. In the BEC limit, we would expect the maximum of these kind of paired signal at 4/3 times the binding energy. And so these are the experimental data that we get. This is for a relatively shallow trap, low power trap. And this, the blue data is for a trap which was recompressed by a factor of 30, roughly. And you see that here, I mean, the BEC limit, this data nicely follows the expectation for the for the molecules. But then, I mean, these changes, and we see some shifts here at the universality point, and also it continues here in that region. It's interesting to plot the ratio of these gap energies for these two different trap compression ratios. And so it is one that doesn't depend on the trap in the BEC limit. At the universality point here, it should be three. It should scale with the Fermi energy. It should be three. And we see almost three here. But then further in the more in the BEC regime, in the BCS regime, it should grow. And we see that in the data. We see ratios up to six or seven here. So let me come back to the collective excitation modes. So let me compare this frequency I see with the collective excitation frequencies, the radial ones. I'm speaking about the radial things. So this is the radial trap frequency. And you see that this pairing gap energy reaches the kind of oscillation energy quantum at 900 Gauss. And this is where we see the abrupt transition. Okay. So it can be interpreted in that way that at this point, so the oscillations couple to the gap, and so this then destroys probably the pairs. And so when we look at the same thing in for a recompressed trap, so this is a 30 times recompressed trap, we say we see this, and we see that there, we expect these a transition at the same magnetic field. Okay, and actually. I don't show the data, but we did these measurements also for the recompressed trap, and we see that the transition point does not significantly shift. It's at 900 Gauss. It's not at fixed KFA, because KFA changes when we do the recompression. It's always at the fixed magnetic field, and this strongly supports our interpretation that the oscillation mode couples to the gap here.
Could you just remind me, how do you define gap here? I missed that, the gap.
Also, okay, in our case, it's just the separation between the two peaks that we see. Yeah, also, in the for the cold sample, it's the maximum of the paired signal, relative to the atom signal, to the position of the atom signal.
When you talked about a ratio, what was the ratio? The gap ratio, what was what?
The ratio of what,
Maybe we can leave Rudy.
So this is for two different for the two different compression two different Fermi energies. Okay, so so this gives us an interpretation of this abrupt change in the spectrum, pair breaking at 910 Gauss, and also might suggest an explanation for the frequencies in the unitarity point which are off. I mean the hydrodynamic prediction, because at the universality point. The ratio between the gap and the oscillation frequency is only a factor of five. So there's no longer a small parameter there, and the simple hydrodynamic theory based on some kind of static response may no longer be valid. So just a last thing here. So we studied in a better controlled way the temperature dependence, and what we did here is we cooled down the sample. To the 90% molecular BEC or more, converted into this universal Fermi gas, and this is the signal we get here, and then we ramp up the trap. But we don't do it adiabatically, but we do it quickly, and so we can introduce a controlled heating, and we end up with a trap at the same trap frequencies and with the same number of atoms. So these data I'm going to show here are taken with the same number of atoms. For the same trap, only the temperature makes a difference. When we heat up the system, we see this at about 0.2 times T Fermi. Again, our double peak structure with the atom peak here and the paired signal here. And then when we go further up with the heating, then we see that this paired fraction goes way down, and here it almost disappears. It's also nice to see that with temperature, I mean, this kind of position of the paired maximum shifts. Okay, so this is the final thing I want to show. This is on resonance. We investigated the line shape of the radio frequency signal and scale it to the Fermi energy. It should be universal here. It should kind of be kind of a universal line shape. And we studied it by varying the trap power over a factor of 30, something like this. And we see that the data really fit to this assumption of a universal kind of line shape. So this is kind of a guide through the eye curve. And you see that the maximum sits at 0.16 times the Fermi energy here. Okay, so let me conclude. So I hope I could convince you that the molecular BEC is a good starting point for doing all these things. In the crossover region, we have investigated several different things. The cloud size as a function of coupling strength, the collective frequencies, and now also the pairing gap as a function of the coupling strength. So this shows certainly interesting effects like the pair breaking, I mean, when the oscillation frequency coincides with the gap energy. And so a little bit into the future, I mean, the question is now, I mean, this radio frequency spectroscopy works very, very nicely. And the question is, what else can this tell us? For example, the line shape. What can we learn from the line shape about the wave function of the pairs? And then, of course, we all want to see a smoking gun of superfluidity in these systems. And the field is progressing so rapidly that I'm sure there will be more surprises and many, many interesting things that we can do in a relatively short time. So thanks for your attention.
Thank you, Rudy. Okay, the audience is very excited by this.
Okay, I want to ask a question. Can you show this gap versus interaction strength again? This dashed line, binding energy, is it the binding energy of one single molecule in vacuum? The question is this actually the first part of the question is the dashed line. Is it the bind? Is 1/a² or?
This is 1/a. It corresponds to 1/a². Actually, we plot the square root of it, so it corresponds to 1/a.
Okay. So did you try to include the simplest mean field correction on the side where you have small molecules? I mean that the actual energy that it costs to break a pair is actually this EB plus the mean field that two fermions experience in the field of bosons.
So we looked. That's of course a very important point. So we looked very carefully into these into kind of density dependent effects. Yes. So we took all these measurements at different compression ratios of the trap and so on, yes. And we find that where we present the binding energy data points. There is no significant dependence on the density of the sample.
But okay. I mean, the small parameter will be A times density to the power of 1/3. So when A is infinite, then you should have large correction.
Yeah, but I mean, this is the kind of the same observation that, I mean, Wolfgang did at the MIT that 1 year ago, that the atom peak is below 700 Gauss, you're in the regime where you see these mean field shifts. But then as soon as you see, I mean, this molecular component, the atom peak is unshifted, I think. So we don't observe a shift there, the atom signal. And I think this is consistent with the MIT observations. And when we look at the molecules and varied density, we also see, I mean, no significant shifts even in the relatively strongly interacting molecular BEC region. On resonance, of course, this breaks down, and I mean, there are some many body shifts. And what we find here is that when we look at the edge of these, what we see here that when we look at the edge, which gives us the binding energy, density-dependent correction is very, very small. But when we look at the shape of the signal, look at the maximum, there's already some other thing happening, some shift showing up.
What's 4/3?
Oh, so this is in the limit. I mean, if you calculate the shape of these RF spectra of the molecules in the pure molecular situation, just by wave function overlap arguments, then you find the maximum, which is at 4 or 3 times the binding energy.
That was my
Maybe you can repeat it because.
Yeah. The question was, where does the 4/3 come from? And you just answered.
It pains me to say so, but I think Alan may have raised an interesting point. he was asking about the dipole slosh frequency, and of course it should always be the same, except of course if the magnetic moment of the molecules is somehow different from the atoms, and evidently it isn't. But I wonder, of course, in the radial frequency, the question is whether the strength of the optical dipole trap, which can have something to do perhaps with how close the atoms are together. Is it possible that the radial slosh frequency changes as you move in across there? And could that account for some of your discrepancy in
Actually,
the radial breathing frequency?
Our measurements on the radial sloshing mode are consistent with, kind of simple model on anharmonicity corrections. So, I mean, we were in contact with Sandro on these anharmonicity things. And he provided us with a little model, how to calculate the corrections. And so our data on the sloshing mode is completely compatible with these little corrections.
But
and there's
no, we can
rule out a kind of magnetic field dependence on that on a level of, I think, very few percent. Due to the trap, so we keep the amplitude as small as we can, so it's usually a 10% amplitude, and so the anharmonicity comes from the fact that our Fermi energy is about 1/3 of the trap depth already.
I just wanted to ask you on your last slides with the temperature dependence. So is this then true that after understanding that the condensation temperature of the pairs is like 0.5 T over TF? Was that what you...
Oh, yeah.
So it's really, really rather high, right? I mean, I don't know.
This is only a very rough estimate of the temperature. I think we all have problems with, giving right values of the temperature. So it can be wrong by... Let's say we convert a conservative by a factor of 2 or so. So it's a first very rough estimate, this temperature.
Okay, so you say there's an uncertainty factor of 2 in all
this?
Yeah. Okay.
It would also be interesting to see these pictures together with the condensate fractions that you measure.
Yeah, so actually that is our best way of doing thermometry. So we measure the condensate fraction in the BEC limit, and we can give these values here. I don't have these numbers right here, but we have these numbers.
I just wanted to make another comment about the cone mode, or what experimentalists call sloshing mode. You guys might think it's obvious, but to theorists, it's always a challenge to make sure you get the cone mode, since it should be there, but you have to prove that it exists. And in the BCS limit, as far as I'm aware, it's never been proven. In any event, Yoji Ohashi and I, mainly him, are just completing a very long, lengthy, many-body paper showing that in the BCS limit, for instance, with fermions and Cooper pairs and what have you, the sloshing mode in the trap is exactly equal to the trap frequency. And I must admit, I did not find the calculation that trivial, as Eric seems to imply, that it's sort of obvious. Why is it obvious, Eric?
The BCS superconductor.
It's a basic symmetry of a harmonic oscillator potential. Just as if you have a completely uniform potential, you can go into a moving frame of reference, which all physics is the same in all moving frame reference. In a harmonic oscillator potential, all physics are in the same in any sloshing frame. So interactions, many body physics, Pauli, bosons, fermions, it's all got to have the same dipole slosh.
You make a big mistake there. No. It's an interesting point in the sense that in an exact calculation, it should be. The question is, BCS and all these theories are not exact calculations. So in the approximate calculation, such as BCS, is it, or the BCS-BCS crossover, in that approximate calculation, is it valid? All theorists should check that the cone frequency does come out of the calculation, because they're in big trouble if it doesn't.
Okay.
If there are no other questions?
Yes, there
Oh, yeah. Jora, last question, then we move on.
Rudy, you showed us a very nice picture where you're somehow the presence of the gap and this behavior of this anomalous behavior of excitations are somehow correlated to each other. Yes, but you know, if I look on what can happen in the BCS limit, which can be wrong, yes, okay, then I would say that I have to get the disappearance of the gap depends on the density and temperature, and in your case it happens at a given magnetic field. You showed us these two curves, so how do I understand that? The question is that Rudy was talking about the pairing gap, and he was presenting the experimental data, and then you had two curves. Yes, I think they were corresponding to different densities or different...
Different compression of the trap.
Yes, so yes. Well, and then...
Its Fermi energy is varied by a factor of three.
Okay, so it's a different density, yes? Then I would expect that if I'm very far from the resonance, I have BCS limit. Yes, in the BCS limit, the pairing gap depends on the density. Yes, so K Fermi A at this point where this stuff disappears, is it larger than one, smaller than one, or what?
K of A is about minus two or minus three. When we compress the trap, it's even larger. So
you're not that far from resonance. Yeah. Right. Okay, so then what you say that at resonance, the disappearance of the gap is more or less density independent, yes, the gap by itself.
He's saying that it coincides exactly with the pair breaking. He's saying that by doing this, shaking it, and you're shaking so many pairs up, the whole thing just breaks loose and becomes normal fluid. So he's evaporating the whole thing into...
I'm asking something else.
Oh, sorry.
Sandro, you need some time to... Okay, so just to the time.
Well, I was just asking whether this pairing gap depends on the density or not.
The microphone, please.
But my voice is sufficiently loud. I think that everybody can hear me. Can everybody hear me?
Yes.
Good.
There's a registration going on.
Good. Okay. But I can also speak over the microphone. So the question is, does the pairing gap, Jason, depend on density or not?
Yeah, it does. It does. It does.
It does.
I showed this in this inset with a ratio of the pairing gap for different coupling strength. Uh-huh. And so the Fermi energy is varied by a factor of three. And we find this factor of three on resonance at the universality point. It's a large... It's a factor of six or seven for higher magnetic field. So it's only three in this universal case, yeah. And it happened that accidentally, I mean, you get the same kind of scaling at these 910 Gauss. You recompress the trap, and the Fermi energy goes up in approximately the same way as the gap energy at that point. And therefore, there's no shift really.
I thought you say the pairing gap measuring that way is one fifth of the Fermi energy.
That is for universality. It's not a dependence in the Fermi gas region.
Okay, let's thank again Rudy. And let's move on to